Okay, at this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements chair meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting or 1 year of continuous sobriety. Have Central as your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. I've met all those requirements. My name is Marty. I'm an alcoholic.
Marty.
My sobriety date's February 15th of 2008. And I came in here homeless and hopeless and was given a little bit of hope. And I remember when I first got here, I could not even fathom a light at the end of any kind of a tunnel. It just was completely dark. And through excellent sponsorship, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, and ultimately a higher power, I was able to start whittling those down a piece at a time. And I found that by using this program one day at a time and making small accomplishments, that long tunnel has grown a little shorter, and I can see a light. I don't think I'll ever reach that light, except maybe after this is all over, you know. But the journey there has been both frustrating and very exciting, and I wouldn't change a minute of it so far. And I know that if I continue to do the next right thing and do what I've been taught in here, I can stay sober one day at a time. I'm very grateful to be here, and I want to thank you for my sobriety. The group's asking me to remind you again to please make sure your cell phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And our speaker, I met Martha when I was in treatment. And I remember, I did not get sober after that treatment center. I went out for another little four-month testing period, so I want to call it that. But I remember when I came back to the rooms and finally got serious about that, one of the first speakers I heard was here, and it was a little over 4 years ago, and I sat in that end chair right over there where Justin's at. And I was fascinated by her story. And in this little bit of sobriety I've gotten, I've had the pleasure of crossing paths with her many times. And I always like what she has to say. And she's got, in my opinion, she's got some really good sobriety that I strive to achieve. So, without further ado, here is Martha.
Okay. My name is Martha Powell, and I am an alcoholic. I want to say something that just blows me away. And I don't say it very often, but my sobriety date is April 2nd of 2002. It's not anything that I ever wanted. It's not anything that I ever thought I could ever have. I didn't know that there was this way of life. But boy, am I so grateful that I'm here today. A little bit about me. I was born in Connecticut. I have three sisters, and my mom died when I was six. And when I was six, I had a cough. And back then, they gave you cough medicine that had codeine and all kinds of good stuff in it. And I remember I got high. And I remember I loved that feeling. And I coughed more and more so that I could get more cough medicine. And that was the first time that I got high. That was my first altered state. It was wonderful, and I chased that for another 40 years. My sisters and my dad, none of them have a drinking or drugging problem. They don't have the crazy obsessions that I have. Don't know how I got it, where I got it. My dad did marry a woman that was an alcoholic and actively drinking when I was 11. But when I was 11, I considered that I was already well raised and done with any mother that wanted to step into any kind of motherly shoes. And so I had nothing to do with her. She was a hated stepmother, and she was a drunk. But when I was 11 and my dad remarried, I got free access to alcohol. I used to drink my dad's beers when I was a kid. You know, he'd have the Saturday, you know, a couple beers, and he'd leave them out all day long while he was working around the yard, and you know, they'd get warm, and he'd take a sip here and there and that kind of stuff. And I think he found that he went through quite a few more beers once I realized that I could drink the beer. So I stole a lot of beer from my dad. But once he married this woman, I really had the opportunity to drink. And the first time that I really drank, I went and got a mason jar and filled it up with whiskey. And she drank whiskey sour, so you put that little powdered stuff in there. And so I put a little powdered stuff in there, and I shook it up. And I went and I sat under a bridge that was, like, we lived out of ways, but there was a highway bridge. And I went and I sat under the highway bridge, and I drank the mason jar full of whiskey, and I went back for more. I don't remember much after that, but I remember that that was just the best thing that ever happened to me in the world. I drank mouthwash when I was in junior high, when I couldn't get liquor. My stepmother went through quite a bit because of me, because they locked up the liquor away from her once they found out that she was an alcoholic. They locked up the liquor, but you know, they told me where the key was, because I was only 12. Anyway, so my dad remarried, and this woman had three children, Tim, Tom, and Susie. And they were way much older. So my older brother, Tom, I didn't know really at all, because he's about 18 years older than me. My stepsister, I call her my sister, Susie, was probably about 15 years older than me. And then Tim. Tim and Tom drank, and they drank heavily. They drank alcoholically. Now, I really couldn't be an alcoholic because, according to them, it runs in your genes. And I didn't have it in my genes. We weren't blood kin. So I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was sure of it. So my stepmother kept wrecking cars, and I thought that was the funniest thing, you know. When I was about 15, I discovered a bar down in downtown New Haven, Connecticut, and the name of the bar was Archie Moore's, and the bartender, you know, the guy that attended bar was named Bob, and I don't know if he was one of us, but he did have a drinking problem. And when I showed up there, he found out that I would tend bar for him at 15, so he could go down in the basement and get as drunk as he wanted to, and I would handle the place for him, because I could drink for free. And I was very young then, and I could drink a lot. And I could make sense for a really long time. And the cash register came up somewhat even, and there was actually money in it. The owner was making money. He was good with it. Bob was good with it. We were all happy. So I told my dad I was going to visit my friend, Archie Moore. I don't know if you know, but Archie Moore is a famous boxer. I didn't know he was a famous boxer. I guess Dad didn't either, or just kind of, you know, Dad just kind of went with it. When my mom died when I was 6, my dad was devastated. So she died, and he left, not physically, but emotionally and mentally. He couldn't handle it. He couldn't deal with it. It was a devastating blow for him, and he's never gotten over it. So there wasn't anybody really around to raise me or watch out for me or watch over me. So I did what I damn well pleased, and I had a great time doing it. I made it through high school by the skin of my teeth. I've worked in restaurants and bars all my life. And I was working in Connecticut, and then I was working the seasons, coming down to Fort Lauderdale for the winter. And then one September, I was packing up my vehicle and getting ready to go back up to Connecticut. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, something's messed up here. You know, it's September, and it's fixing to get cold in Connecticut. I never said fixing before either. I'm from Connecticut. But I have a husband that's a Florida cracker, so. So I was fixing to get cold up there, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is messed up. I need to just stay. So I did. But I started, you know, losing track of time, and it really wasn't important anyway. So I lived in South Florida from when I was about 18 on, and worked in bars. Had a good old time, and I never really quit a job or got fired from a job. If a better opportunity came along, I just left, you know, and then I'd come back, and if they take me back, that was great. If they didn't take me back, that was okay too. While I was in Connecticut working in bars, I rented a cold water flat, and It was a straight through railroad flat is what we called it. Like you walk in the kitchen and then you go from the kitchen to the living room to the next room to the next room, you know, and it was straight through. There wasn't any other doors to get in or out. And there wasn't any heat and there wasn't any hot water, and it's cold up in Connecticut. And there was a night that it was really cold and there wasn't any heat, and I was laying in my sleeping bag and I heard fire trucks, and they sounded like they stopped right in front of that house, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, I wonder if the house is on fire. And then I thought about it and I said, well, it would be a lot warmer if it was on fire. So I didn't go up and look, but the hot dog crack factory across the street burned down. But that was my thinking, you know. Nothing was really important. Didn't really give a damn about anyone or anything. All my boyfriends were nexts. And I went from the Coldwater flat that was $65 a month to I wasn't making that much money, so it was kind of like if you had a roof over your head and you looked decent and you know and you bought me what I wanted, I'm good with you, you know, and I moved in. And then when you didn't like me anymore, I moved on, you know, or I didn't like you anymore, whatever, and I moved on. You know, it was just a convenient thing. But anyway, so when I came down to Florida, I guess that same thinking followed me, and I found a guy that lived on a sailboat. And I thought, great, this is going to be great fun, you know. And so we went to the Bahamas on a regular basis, and liquor in the Bahamas is very cheap. And so we had to sail over to the Bahamas because the boat had to leave. The boat was foreign registered, so it had to leave the United States on a regular basis. So we go over to the Bahamas and we just buy big gallon jugs of vodka. Well, he drank gin, I drank vodka, and just you know, really nothing was important. It was all about having a good time. I got to be about 32, and I say about 32, I could sit down and figure out specifically when, but like I said, nothing was really important. So I was about 32, and someone suggested the idea that I should get married. Why wasn't I? Asked me if I'd been married, and I thought, what a novel idea. So I married the bar owner's son, who inherited the business. And by that point, you know, he had three bars. And I worked when I wanted to, when I wanted a little extra money. When I didn't work, when I didn't want to work, I didn't work. Definitely was not having children. I had decided that early on in life that would have interfered with my lifestyle, my partying, my whatever. You know, I didn't have time for that. That was a responsibility, and I didn't do it. I didn't care if next was married, divorced, had kids, didn't make any difference. But anyway, so I decided it was time to get married, so I got married. And I remember in the morning of my wedding, I was drinking beer, and my dad said something to me about, you really think you should be having another beer? And that was the only time that I ever remember my dad saying anything about my drinking. Now, remember, he's dealt with an alcoholic who, actually, she got sober, and Dad sent her to Betty Ford, which is another resentment that I have dealt with, because I went to the Center for Drug-Free Living. But anyway, she got sober, and I don't know if she got sober the first time or not. Her older son, Tom, got sober, and he's got probably 30-something years. He's my older brother. He loves me unconditionally, and he is awesome. He's in this program. My sister Susie doesn't drink. She's just off. She's just different, and that's okay. Somewhere in this mess, my brother Tim was fixing to go to jail and prison for a long time. They were taking him from Tampa, Florida, back to Connecticut to put him in the VA hospital. Or actually, no, they were going to put him in prison, and he set fire to the airport. So they put him in the VA hospital. He had a serious drinking and drugging problem. And he was scared to death. So that's why he did that. Anyway, it came a time when the VA up in Connecticut, the unions were getting ready to strike. And the VA called my dad and his mother and said, "We can't keep your son anymore because we're closing down. So we're going to send him home to you." My dad loved Tim. My dad never had a son, but he loved my brother, Tim. And Tim loved my dad. Anyway, they sent him home. And untreated alcoholism is an insane thing. They never left my brother alone for about 2 months. There came the time inevitable where they had to leave him alone for a couple hours, and he hung himself in the basement. My dad was devastated. He felt like he could have done something. That was, you know, I was still drinking. It wasn't anything important to me. So, okay, so I'm down in South Florida, and I'm married and having a good old time, and got in a motor vehicle accident, and decided it would be a good thing to, like, mix pills with. Oh, I didn't tell you, my husband was an addict. He was not an alcoholic, but he was an addict. He had papers to prove it. Anyway, so he hated it when I drank, and it really bothered, you know, him. And I would have to lock myself in a room to go drink because he would get violent when I drank, and I would get hurt. So I would. It was important for me to drink, so I'd go lock myself in a room so that I could drink. I was also doing drugs at the time, and my husband kept getting arrested, getting my drugs. And he'd call me up and he'd say, "Will you come bail me out?" And I'd say no. And he went into, had got involved with drug court, and I had to drive him to these damn AA meetings. And I never, ever went in. Ever. Because I wasn't an alcoholic. And it really irritated the crap out of me that I had to stay sober or somewhat. I had to be able to drive. Because I had to get him to the AA meetings. Otherwise, he was going to prison. So I had to be able to drive. And it really pissed me off. Because it was interfering with me, with my whatever good time. As with any good practicing alcoholic and addict, we lost everything. Well, we gave away everything that we owned, and we ended up homeless, living on the streets. And I lived on the streets with my husband for a couple of years. And we'd go in a flop house here and there, and his family down in South Florida would come in and take us out to get something to eat, only if I could stay somewhat sane and coherent. And I couldn't do that very often, and it really used to piss him off because he was hungry and he wanted to go eat. But I could not keep myself. I didn't care enough. I was. This is when I started waking up in hospital emergency rooms. And the first time that it happened, I was in a room, and there was a woman sitting in the corner, and she was reading a book. And I thought, what is she watching? Why is she here? Anyway, I found out later I was on suicide watch. But they never committed me. And then the next time, so when I realized what was going on, I went, you know what, I gotta go. So I unhooked everything and I left. So the next time that I went in, you know, and near death again, they put me in restraint so that I couldn't unhook everything. And somehow they got in touch with my husband, and he came and he let me out of the restraints and let me out. And so next time I was in there, they had me in restraints with little padlocks on them. But actually, my husband and I both were taking turns, you know, and they gave him Haldol one time, and I decided that Haldol would be a really good thing for me to do. It wasn't. It was a really bad scene, but I tried it. So as you can probably see, any port in a storm, any person I could use, including my dad, who's 93, didn't really care. My brother died of this disease. Came a day when I don't know what happened. I don't know what was different. But I said, help. And it was swift. I called my best friend, Jeannie, who had stuck by me for 20 years. I always had a key to her house. But I would never use it because she had young kids, and I felt like that wasn't... they didn't need to see me. So I called her, and she drove me up to Orlando and took me to Paramore and Gore. And they didn't know what to do with me because I was less than 90 pounds. I had most of my teeth pulled out for drugs. My hair was all kind of scraggly and skanky and stuff like that. But I knew I looked good. So I get into detox, and they do the methadone detox and the Librium and all that other stuff, and I was there for about 3 days, and I really, really wanted to take a shower. I really wanted to take a shower, but I couldn't figure out how. So I had a roommate, and man, she was like the cheerleading type, you know, blonde hair with painted fingernails. She was very pretty. And I asked her to help me to take a shower. I don't know how she knew how to tell me what to do, but what she said, like, she, you know, we were in the room, and she pulls out her shampoo and her soap, and she's got soap, body soap, and she's got face soap, and she's got really good smelling shampoo, and she's got cream rinse, and she's got this, and she's got that. And she goes through all the motions, and she says, okay, you're going to use this soap on your face, and you're going to use this soap for your body, and you're probably going to want to wash your hair twice, but you're going to go in, and you're going to use this particular stall, you're going to hang your dirty clothes here, put your clean clothes here, hang your towel here, and you're going to go in, and she said, and you're going to lather, and she went through the motions, so I was able to go into the shower, and I heard her voice in my head, and I was able to take a shower. I don't know how she knew how to tell me how to do that. So I'm in detox, and I meet a guy, and I meet a couple guys. But these guys were for Next, but this one guy knew how. I'm still married, by the way. My husband's still in South Florida, but I hated him, boy. Oh, I hated him because he made me a damn alcoholic and drug addict. You know, it was so his fault. It was so his fault. I hated him with such blind white hate. I've never felt that in my life. But I'm still looking at a Next. But I also make a friend. And this guy knows how to take buses around Orlando. And he comes in handy later. Anyway, I get to the adult residential or whatever, and they start bringing me here to Central. And I sit in the back, and it was the coolest thing because, like, they go around the room, and I got, you know, and I sat in the smoking room, and I sat in the way back, and I figured they'll never ever get to me. But I found out that I could say my name, say I was an alcoholic, and pass. That was the best thing because I was scared to death of you people. There was no way I was going to ever talk around you, near you, whatever. And I did not want you guys hugging me, talking to me. I didn't want anything to do with you because I was scared to death of you people. If you knew who I was, if you knew what I'd done, you wouldn't even let me stay here, just sit in the back of the room. And I knew that. But I kept showing up, and I kept sitting in the back of the room, and they're talking about get a sponsor, get a big book, read your big book. And I'm in a treatment center, and we're doing great things. We're going canoeing and kayaking and white water, and 4 and 5 day river trips and those kind of things, and I'm getting my strength back because I didn't think I could ever do those things again. You know, and I have a counselor, and I'm talking to the counselor, and I don't know what you talk to a counselor about, and I still really don't know what you talk to a counselor about. But, you know, you go sit in their office, and they tell you to hang with the winners, and then they tell you not to be judgmental, and, you know, all this kind of, you know. But I really didn't understand much. I had drank and drugged for so long that I was not sane. But I would have called you a liar and told you you were so wrong if you told me I was insane. I am not insane. But if I look back at the things that I did to myself, a sane person doesn't do those things. I know that today. I didn't know that then. Anyway, so I got a sponsor. Actually, she came up to me and she gave me her phone number. And I didn't call her. And I saw her again and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, yeah, call me. So I called her. But she was in law school and she was really busy, which was a good thing because I would call her and pray for the answering machine. And I get the answering machine and I go, hi DJ, this is Martha, you told me to call, so I call and I hang up the phone. But it got me in the habit of calling. And it got me, you know, able to make a phone call. Anyway, so she was my first sponsor. She didn't make it either, which is an awful thing. But we do die. Anyway, and then enter the guy that I met in detox that knows how to take the bus. This guy, I could get to a meeting across town, the other side of the world, whatever. He could get me on the bus. He'd tell me what side of the street to stay on, what side of the bus to get off, if I should cross the street or not. He knew exactly where every meeting was in town, and he got me to every single meeting. I showed up in meetings, and I sat in the back of the room, and no one bothered me, and I'm so grateful that they didn't. And no one chased me out, and I just showed up, and I just kept showing up. And I just kept listening, and you guys were happy, joyous, and free. And you guys were just okay with yourselves, and that's all I wanted. I wanted to just be, you know, to be able to take that breath, to just be okay. Anyway, so I don't know how whoever knew that was a good path for me, but somehow that Kenny was put in my life, and he got me to meetings. He also had a friend, and man, she was just, I don't know, just had something about her, just kind of peaceful and okay. You know, she was okay with the stuff that she did. You know, I'd do something and I go, man, did I do that wrong? Did I insult that person? Did I, you know? And she was okay with the stuff that she was doing. But she also would like be able to talk to people, you know? And I wanted what she had. And I said, will you ask her? She'll be my sponsor. He said, no. You've got to ask her. So I summed up my courage and I asked her and she said yes. And I was her first sponsee. And she had me to her house, allowed me in her house every Tuesday. I took the bus, and she had me take the bus every day that I got, you know, that I went over to there. I took the bus there, and I took the bus home most of the time because, you know what, I needed to know how to do that, and I needed to build a little bit of self-esteem to know that, you know, it's kind of like making your bed in the morning. If you do it, it just feel a little bit, if I do it, I feel a little bit better about myself. I don't know what it is, but like the next right thing, the esteemable thing, somebody told me, you know. So anyway, I showed up there, and if I didn't understand something in the big book, she'd get another book out, and we'd go through that, and she'd explain it this way, and she'd explain it that way, and I didn't understand anything in this book at all. But I worked the steps with her, and then with another sponsor. God kept putting these people in my life. I would have never found them on my own. Oh, and by the way, the God thing, it said in here something about, it says something in here, there's a sentence, and this means we're going to talk about God, and we agnostics, and I thought, oh, great. If I have to have a God, I am not going to get sober. I don't know anything about God. I wasn't raised in the church. I know there's a power greater than myself, because look at the way that, you know, the birds that eat the worms, the you know, just the way that things work. I couldn't figure that out. I don't think any of you guys can figure that out. So there had to be a power greater than myself, but this God thing. And I was told, somebody in here told me, work the steps, you'll be contacted. So I did. and I was. You know, evidence of God in my life. And if I look back through all the things that have happened to me from when I was a child up until when I got into these rooms and beyond, you know, if I make a list of evidence of God in my life, it'll blow you away. Because it does me every time. So, powerless over alcohol, life was unmanageable. I didn't know what manageable was. I really didn't. You know, I figured eating out of the Winn-Dixie dumpster was a good idea because I didn't have to pay for the food. I had more important things to do with my money. You know, I figured taking hostages was a good idea because men make more than women and they're able to pay rent and keep a roof over my head. That was how I managed my life. I didn't know any different. I didn't know any better. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I'm still not admitting that I was insane, but something was wrong. You know, and I thought that, like, I was scared to death that they were going to put me up in the attic, you know, and, like, you know how when you're sitting downstairs and somebody goes, "What's that noise?" And they go, "Oh, that's Auntie Martha. She's okay. She's up in the attic. We don't let her out much." That was going to be me. I knew that was going to be me. So, made a decision to turn my will, and that's important, my will and my life. See, I can turn my life over to just about anyone or anything, you know, but my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Very little understanding, still very little understanding, but working on a faith. You know, and I'm no longer staying sober by fear alone, because I was scared to death to go back where I was. And by the way, when I was in the treatment center about a month, my dad called and spoke to the director and told him that my husband in South Florida had passed away. He also died of this disease. We were married 13 years. It was all insane. And I get to make amends to my new husband for that. But anyway, so I came to believe that power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. I knew what I had done. I was tired of living in what I had done. I was tired of having those closed doors down the hallway in my head and all those people and those committees that were judging me and saying, "You'll never ever be good enough to be around other people. You'll always be Auntie Martha up in the attic and you should never come out." And then the committee would go back in their room and they'd shut the door and scare the heck out of me because I didn't know what they were going to do next. So I made that searching and fearless moral inventory as best I could. It wasn't a great one at that time, but as best I could. And then I told another person. And a lot of people talk about the, you know, after the fifth step, that, you know, you, the weight's lifted off and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have that experience. So I made a list of all the persons we had harmed, I had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all. And I did leave some people out on that list, but they're on it now. But I made amends to my dad. I called him up, and I also spoke to him in person. And I said, "Dad, I'm sorry for all the shame and embarrassment that I caused you in this town. I'm sorry for the worrying and the things that I put you through. What can I do?" And he said, "Oh, Mart, you didn't really worry me that much, or you didn't put me through all that." And I thought, you know what? He's from New England. They're staunch, upstanding, blue blood type. "Oh, no," he said, "you didn't, you know, you didn't." But he started crying. Okay. And part of my ninth step amends, I went up. My dad had surgery for the first time in his life last year. And I went up and I spent 47 days with him while he was having surgery. And the reason I know it's 47 days is because my dad was telling his friends, "You know, my daughter's been up here from Florida. She's got a family and everything, but she's been up here 40, 40 days, 45 days, 47 days. Yep, my daughter came up to take care of me, 47 days. He said, you know, Mark, you don't have to do this. And I said, no, I know, Dad. But you know what? I want to. You know, I want to be here for you. And I did the best I could to be there for my dad. Amazing. From a person that didn't give a damn if you lived or died, to hostages every day. Didn't care if my dad was... I didn't even make any difference, you know. And I spent 47 days with my dad up there. And continued to take personal inventory, and when I was wrong, promptly admitted it. If I don't promptly admit it, I don't sleep at night. But I got to tell you, I'm married. And that, you know, it's like I watch what I say more often than I let it slip, but every once in a while things come out and I have to go back and apologize, because I don't have disposable friends anymore. And I don't have disposable husbands either. You know, but I have that tool. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, the God of my understanding. I read other literature, different books, to enlarge my God. And He is huge. Getting bigger every day, though. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these deaths, I try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. You know what? The principles, honesty, integrity, brotherly love, it's not easy. You know? It's not easy. But at least I have a guide. I have a way, a direction. I never had direction before. I've got direction. And I've got this book. And you can see it's pretty tore up. But this is my book of life. It tells me. We pause when agitated. Upon awakening, when I'm angry, God save me from being angry. This is a sick person. You know, fear, remove the fear. Direct me to what you would have me be. It's all in here. You know, when I do something or say something or whatever, when I feel uncomfortable, acceptance, you know. Nothing happens in this in God's world by mistake. You know, I've been dealing with an insurance company, and I'm telling you, I called my sponsor and I said, I don't think that they're in God's world. She assures me that they are. But, and you know what blows me away? Is that there's so many people here that have touched my life in such a strong way, they have no idea. They made me the person that I am today. It blows me away to think about how, like, I look around and like, I know almost everybody here. That's crazy. And I even like just about everybody here. That's even crazy. Because that was never me. If you had something I wanted, I got it. Of course, not from you guys, because you guys are alcoholics too, and you didn't give it up easy. But you know, the manipulating and all that other stuff that I used to do, I don't do that so much anymore. You know, and I just left the house. Now my husband's a big NASCAR fan, but we have people over the house on a regular basis, all the time actually. We work with a couple treatment centers, and we stay busy that way. So anyway, I left a few people back at the house watching the NASCAR race. You know, and it was funny because they asked me, you know, are you sure you don't mind if I watch the NASCAR race instead of going to see you speak? I'm like, no, go ahead, stay home. You know? Yeah. But, you know, people show up at my house and they're welcome there and there's food there. And I have a dog and a cat and they live better than a lot of kids I know. You know? And I have found that, among other things, the more I give, the more I get. My life overflows every day. So this idea that I had to get a God that scared me to death, that I thought, I'll never get sober if I have to get God. I came in here and you guys said, just work the steps. It's that easy. Just work the steps. I have a God today that takes care of me in all ways. And I just want to end with my favorite promises. And there are people that will tell you how many promises are in this book. There's a lot of them. There's promises for every step and then some. There's good promises and there's also some bad promises. Like, do this and you'll get drunk. They promise you that in here. These are my promises. And it has words like sincerely. I was never sincere. I could act real good, but I was never sincere. So it talks about, this is the how and why of it, on page 62 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is my book of life. I didn't get this book when I was born. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. I know that for sure. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, and we are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Man, he loves me. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Thank you for that.